all of them.
They all the live is on right now, so just FYI, cool. heads up for anybody that's out there already on Bitcoin Spaces. This is kind of the pre-show where we warm up with the guest. We've got Kevin Rash with us tonight, Gabe and Alex and myself. We are minus Mike Hobart, and we fired Jordan. We just said, you know what, man, if you can't show up, then no.
You're just too weird.
We'll see.
The FBI visited itself.
That's right. Yeah, hey, Gabe, we were just watching this clip that that Nico put out about Tucker Carlson out in Buenos Aires talking about the inflation of currency.
Mm-hmm. It's wild.
Yeah, it's wild. For a guy that's talking about like assassination and stuff, man, it is it's kind of a nuts thing.
He's definitely out there disrupting some stuff right now.
He's got probably the most reach of any person on the planet right now.
Of course, you're probably right.
It used to be Joe Rogan, right up until the point where he started getting 195 million views per episode.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, like, you know, what these guys are head to head these days. That'd be an interesting statistic.
I guess Rogan's like 11 million on average, right? Something like that.
Per show or per month?
Yeah, per show.
Wow.
Yeah, when what's Tucker get these doing?
You gotta get these numbers up, boys. Record numbers. Hell and married you guys.
Kissing in the wind over here is what we're doing. For God's sakes.
But yeah, but Tucker, I think there was one that, oh, I know which one it was. It was the one that he did with Trump. I think that one did 195 million views. It's probably higher by now.
That's good for your stats. You get positive outlier there. Yeah,
it's all right. It's all right.
It's all right. Yeah.
It's a start. He might do something with himself one day.
See what happens when he really starts to apply himself.
Yes.
Is he exclusively broadcasting on Twitter?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's rebranded his entire thing to Tucker on X. Well, it's now Tucker on X. It was Tucker on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It was Twitter. And now he calls it Tucker on X, and that's the show.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Hopefully he sees how that's a centralized weapon of control soon. Or will.
Yeah, but it's also a platform for reach, right? Because there's decentralized platforms now. There's like Nostr and things like that.
Right.
But you know, people ask me the question, well, Alex, why don't you get on Nostr? And it's like, well, it's because we're trying to teach all the people who aren't on Nostr about Bitcoin, and they're not on Nostr. They're on.
It's a good point.
X. Yeah.
Nostr is sand of the beach in terms of Bitcoin.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Yep. Totally.
Yeah. There's definitely a progression there.
It's just to wrap up the point about Tucker talking about this. It's fantastic because we are at a point in time where vast portions of the human race are now thinking about what money is. If you were to rewind the clock 15 years, nobody was talking about this stuff.
I mean, even 3 years ago, think about, I mean, just the difference in 3 years. That statistic that's out there, and I think I'm going to give credit to Brian DeMint, the guy that wrote the Bitcoin Evangelism. Yeah. Brian said something in that book about, you know, it takes as long to go from 0 to 10% adoption as it does from 10 to 90% adoption. And when he wrote the book, I guess it was somewhere around the end of 2021, we were already sitting at somewhere around 12-15%. Don't quote me on that, but like somewhere around there. So you're sitting there going like, holy cow, you know, if we're looking at this and we're going, if we took that long, you know, 2009 to 2021 to get, you know, the first 12%, and now, you know, you're looking at maybe another 10 years to get to 90%. Holy God. I mean,
so the thing that I wonder about when I hear stuff like that is, number one, how are you defining adoption? What does that
mean? I think it's just standard bell curve, I think, is what he was pulling from in terms of.
No. What I'm saying is, what is the definition of adoption to you? Does that mean you bought $50 worth of Bitcoin? Does that mean you've adopted it? You know what I mean? Like what does that exactly mean? Does that mean you have X amount of your net worth in it? Does it mean you use it for transactions? Do you think it's money or do you think it's an investment? Like, what does that all mean? Is it just something you heard of? Because at this point, I think a lot of humans have heard of it.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's. I would imagine it's the lowest bar outside of not taking action. Right. So I think, you know, taking action is probably the catalyst there, and it's probably a low bar in terms of, oh yeah, you know what, I bought some Bitcoin on Cash App or Swan or wherever, right? And you're just like, yeah, maybe that's what it is.
Why does Swan got to be part of a low bar thing, man?
What was that all about? Swan's, I mean, all that trouble with green screens and, you know, all these companies, you know. Some good news coming about that. We're not going to announce it here, but definitely some good news. So stay tuned to Swan. There's some stuff that is going to rip people.
Press release coming. That's going to floor people, I think.
Okay. It's so good. It's going to be great. With that, gentlemen, are you guys buckled in, ready to start this thing?
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's kick it. Welcome to Bitcoin Veterans, everybody. I'm Shane Hazel. I'm joined by Alex and Gabe tonight. Our guest is Kevin Rash. He is the co-founder of Return to Duty and also the head of operations. He served 23 years in the United States Air Force, did a lot of work as a chaplain, was both enlisted and officer. So he's seen both sides of it there. And he's worked both with unconventional and conventional forces. And has got tons of stories. He's a man after my own heart in terms of family, being outdoors. And, you know, we got to talk a little bit earlier during a sound check. And I got to tell you, I'm excited to have you, Kevin. Appreciate you joining us tonight.
Hey, thank you guys for having me.
Yeah. So we were just kind of talking about everything that's going on out there in the space in terms of adoption. And I learned earlier that you're already fairly orange pilled and ready to go and even look at the space. So if anybody's out there that's looking for guys and everything else, you can always hit us up. Kevin is in the, I guess, market for a Bitcoin position too. So keep that in mind as we go through the night. And I think you're going to find out that this guy is doing some pretty amazing things in his life, and I think he's ready to continue that. So thanks again for joining us, man. Let's kind of go through a little bit of your background and then kind of jump into this today.
Yeah. So I'll jump in. I'll just do my military background. Joined the Air Force in 1998 as an enlisted guy. Did a six-year enlistment. I was a communication electronics guy. It's basically the stuff you see at a commercial airport, all those orange and white boxes. I worked on that stuff for 6 years. That was a great time. I applied to go to the Air Force Academy while I was in. Was pretty eager to accomplish as much as I could and got accepted to the Air Force Academy and then chose to turn it down and through a series of circumstances decided I wanted to go to seminary, got a degree in theology, became a pastor, and then became a chaplain in the reserves. So in 2004, I got out, lived through and worked through 9/11, so we can talk about that story in a little bit, and then became a reserve officer. My wife and I met in 2003. She was an F-16 engine mechanic, and we met in the NCO course, so we were a big scandal. You know, you go to a PME course, and there's a couple that comes out of it, and we were married within, you know, 9 months of that. So we got married 2003. She stayed active. I went to grad school. Fast forward 2008, and we find out that she's pregnant with triplets. She has triplets. She's still active. So I take care of the triplets for 14 months. It was literally like SEER school. For anyone who takes advantage of portions of that. So I just tried to stay in the circle.
Of course.
Man, it was awesome. But it was amazing. And then she got out of active duty. and I went back to doing active duty chunks of orders as a reservist, went up to Beale Air Force Base, worked in the ISR community for a little bit, came back down to Luke. My enlistment was all at Luke Air Force Base in the F-16 community, supporting that world. And then was in the reserve unit there, did full-time kind of gigs at the Reserve F-16 squadron, and then also did some event planning for the Air Force. So I traveled around the country for a couple of years doing deployment events, yellow ribbon type stuff. So event planning was a sort of special duty I did for a while. Then I got asked to go back active duty in 2014. Big Air Force called me and said, we need some more chaplains. Will you come on active duty? So I said, yes. Went to Holloman Air Force Base in 2014. From there to 2017, served there on active duty, did a deployment to Afghanistan for a little over a couple hundred days, had a great opportunity to work in supporting the both conventional forces, and then got picked up to support Special Operations Task Force there, Siege of SOTIF A, and worked with ODA, or Green Berets, and then came back from that, left active duty, went across the street, became a GS civilian working in the test and evaluation community. So for 2 years, I was an acquisition program manager, building future capability, stealth, GPS jamming, a bunch of other things. And so I wasn't building them. I was just a nobody in an office helping the programs move forward. And then in the reserves, I moved over to a PJ unit, so rescue unit out of Tucson. So I'd drive over to Tucson for a few years, once a month, and then got called back to the active duty status in the reserves to come here out to Florida, where I live in Central Florida now. Spent the last 6 years of my career working in the rescue community as a reservist, left the GS position, and then I retired from the reserves in 2022, February. And then right before I retired, did a little deployment with some Jays over in Iraq. So yeah, that's the short version of my 23 years in the United States Air Force.
I'm going to echo Nick France here. Taking care of triplets, man. I remember the early mornings, the late nights, and all that kind of stuff. And when you've got one going, if not two going, you know, during the night, but three going, never sleep, always hungry, always, you know, wet or shitty or something.
Dude. Yeah. So when they come out of the NICU, so in a triplet mom max, you know, gestation is like 36 max, right? So she gave birth at 32 weeks and 2 days. So the kids were 214, 34, and 35. So little bitty folks. And then she only got 6 weeks of terminal leave. So we were in the NICU for 5 weeks, sleeping in the rooms and feeding kids. And they come out of the NICU, neonatal intensive care unit, on a 3-hour feeding schedule. So when I got them to the house, dude, I built a log. And I wrote down like when I got each of them up, if they poop, if they peed, how much I fed them, because I was dealing with sleep deprivation. Because if I fed them at midnight, I had to be up at 11:45, warm 3 bottles, grab one, feed them, burp them, swaddle them, change the diaper, blah, blah, blah. And then by the time that was done, it was an hour and a half into it. So now I'm like 1:30, 1:45, and I got a 3 o'clock feeding. So I just locked in. And then turns out all, you know, most dudes are scared of babies, and I understand it. So I basically didn't have any friends for 14 months. So I was really socially isolated and slammed working on the kids. And then my wife, we wouldn't know it for a couple of years, but postpartum hit her, having to go to work. So she's busy. We're passing in the hallway. And dude, it was insane. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. But I wouldn't trade it for the world because, you know, I got to spend time with my kids. And then we had another child, Graham, in 2010. So we have we had another one. And then my wife sent me to the vet and, you know, did the deal.
Very cool.
That is awesome.
She said, you can't do triplets again, I bet.
Yeah, she's like, exactly. She's like, man, like, I've already had enough surgeries. I've already done enough stuff. You go in there and get your junk messed with.
Good Lord, man. That's a whole different episode, man, just talking about raising triplets right there. They should have a medal of honor for the endeavors that you achieved in there.
Hazardous duty.
You know, being a dad is amazing. Yeah. Most people like hard, anything extraordinary requires extraordinary effort, you know, and being a dad is awesome. So if we had more men that would step up and do their job just as dads and husbands and even just members of the community, we wouldn't have such a punk ass community.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Well said.
True. True story.
So tell us about return to duty. What are you guys doing over there?
Yeah, so Return to Duty exists to bring the latest in neck and spine care, neurosurgery, minimally invasive procedures to tactical athletes. So U.S. Special Operation operators, particularly ground operators, platform operators, like, you know, spooky pilots and that kind of stuff, those they're considered tactical athletes, especially the ground operator, because of the amount of effort we put into training them. And so they have built what are called preservation of the force and family teams, interdisciplinary teams. So you have a full-time licensed, a certified strength and conditioning specialist, and they usually have to come from at least a AAA team, pro team, or D1 college, or, you know, high-level experience. And we usually have a chaplain on the team. There's a psych doc. There's usually a nutritionist, a physical therapist. And so we treat these folks as elite athletes. And yet in the DOD, when we get injured, as any of you may have experienced, if you hurt your back, what do they say? They say, go to physical therapy. And then you got to do physical therapy first. And you go back to your primary care physician or PCM, primary care manager. And they say, hey, you know, go back to physical therapy or now get a referral. Then you go to a doc. And then if you go to a doc in the local area, you may or may not be presented the latest options. But if a professional athlete or a D1 athlete gets hurt, they get images immediately that night or the next day, and they're assessed for the optimal care, and no procedure is off the table. So to give you an example, when Tiger Woods hurt his back, came back from that and won the Masters, he went to Texas Back Institute, where they offer every single procedure, including the minimally invasive procedures, which you don't have to destroy a bunch of material through the back to put a bunch of hardware in there and unnecessarily create long-term health issues with the back. So we're trying to bring those latest capabilities in neurosurgery to tactical athletes. And the way we're doing that is because a few of my best friends are Green Beret medics, and they work in the minimally invasive spine surgery space. So we had access and placement and realized these things were going on. And we were helping a handful of guys here and there. This dude's back's hurt, back is hurt. Send him to Peter Derman at Texas Back Institute, or Lynn McGrath, who's the New York Giants neurosurgeon that works out of Cornell in New York City. We'd be sending a handful, onesies and twosies, in different directions. And finally, several of the surgeons and all of us were kind of talking about it. And they're like, let's just start a nonprofit and see if we can advocate for this change to happen. And in the meantime, we will educate operators when they're injured and help them determine the best course of action for themselves. And then they can go back to their military provider and try to get that help. So I don't know if that explains it, but that's the long and short of it.
There's a lot. I mean, experiences may vary. I was told to rub some Sudafed on mine. You know, like, we've got this 800 milligrams of Motrin here, but the Sudafed, just put that on there. You'll be all right.
Yeah. Eat that Ranger candy, boy. You guys know what Ranger candy is, right? The ibuprofen?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of.
Yep. Just chew it yeah. right up.
Right. And the other thing, too, we see with is in the medical community, I mean, in the special operations community, a lot of these guys will, they will ignore most pain signals and stress signals. There's a lot of stress inoculation taught. There's a lot of, you know, preparation for very difficult circumstances, denying yourself. So they will disregard a pain signal or a stop signal. And that usually gets them through, especially the lion's share of their career. But with neck and spine, you know, they have nods on all the time. They're doing jumps. They're doing halo. There's a lot of, you know, there can be hard openings. They're rucking a lot, carrying a lot of gear, just ammo. If you've been around teams, it's a totally different animal. It's not just putting on IBA. So we're stressing their neck and spine. And all we're simply trying to do is go, hey, there's some innovation happening out in the civilian world. Let's do what we can to make the DOD aware. So we're very connected to SOCOM and the Care Coalition and a lot of the medics within the soft community. And in the meantime, we're going to try to, you know, advocate for change. So yeah, it's an uphill battle, but it's not a battle against the surgeons or anything. It's just the government's huge. And whenever you're trying to change something, I mean, you know, whatever.
Yeah. And if anybody's out there that's struggling with some herniated disc or anything like that, definitely take these guys up on, you know, what they do and maybe check with them. And if you're not a D1 athlete or anything like that, or, you know, maybe yeah. hear what they have to say. I will tell you from personal experience, there's some amazing new technology out there. PLDR is post-cutaneous laser decompression, where there is no incision. You know, they basically come in through fiber optic and they ablaze and shrink the disc off of the nerve, which is the problem, seal that disc back up. and you know, you're back up and running within, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, which is absolutely incredible, and very minimal pain for that matter.
Yep.
Yeah, this is super cool, man. So how on earth with all this, how did you get introduced to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I was for years I paid attention to the stock market and tried to, you know, invest my money. So I'm a hustler just by trade. I've always liked to work. I've loved business. As a kid, I was a street kid in Memphis growing up. And after my family imploded in North Memphis, I became a street entrepreneur, and I uncovered the way that those markets work, and looked for margin in those spaces, and then realized it wasn't very wise. And so I got a job when I was 15. I've had multiple jobs, became a manager of a detail shop for 3 years when I was from, you know, like 16 to 19. So I've always enjoyed, you know, working hard. The military was great. I got my realtor's license when I was a young airman, rented out rooms, bought houses in the boom, the bubble, really. And so my bonus, while everybody was buying trucks, I put my money in Janus Mutual Funds and watched the NASDAQ balloon up in the dot-com bubble. So I was watching Fox Business and all that stuff. So I was kind of watching the market, really didn't understand what I was looking at. I didn't know at the time that the real economy was decoupling from the financial economy through all these bubbles, but I was kind of paying attention and watching all that. And I've watched the national debt for 20 years on and off. So through COVID, I was playing around on the internet. I'm an information junkie, and I saw Michael Saylor, and he was talking about Bitcoin, and I was like, what's this dude talking about? And then I watched some Breedlove stuff and looked around at, you know, so you go down the rabbit hole and you start to go, oh my gosh. And there was that moment in late 2020 where I'm like, I need to have Bitcoin. And then I had to do the whole, you know, download, get an account with different exchanges and try to buy it and buy a cold wallet and all that stuff. And I bought it. And then I did something really smart, because I'm probably smarter than any of the dudes on this podcast. Then I started trading crypto. Like a lot of people do. And so, dude,
we finally saw that, right?
So I was listening to Keith McCullough, and I was doing the quads, and I had a crypto quant I was reading every day. I had technical analysis, bro. I was so smart, you don't even know. And then and then I gave all that money back, because I was
give back. That's very kind of you to do that.
And it's very generous. Like, I'm such a moron, and I had to pull my reserve out of cold storage and then trade in a very disciplined way just to get back my initial investment. I got my initial investment back through, you know, if I was up 50%, I was out. I mean, 5%, I was out. If I was down 0.5%, I was out. Dude, I was leveraging it on Kraken. That was back when you could trade it on Kraken in 2021. So yeah, I was a total moron. I thought I was smart, and I almost lost my complete, like, everything, at least my investment. And then I rediscovered it in later on that year, and then in 2022 began to just read more, and I now barely understand it, I would say it that way, but I believe it's the future, and this parallel economy needs to be built.
Damn.
Outstanding.
Wow.
We finally refer to that as climbing Mount Stupid.
Oh, dude. Yeah, dude. I was
the journey climbing. We all take at one point. Generally.
Yeah, I was like, what's his name? What's the Greek story? Sisyph. Who's the dude that pushes the rock, the stone up, and then it rolls back, and then he pushes it back again? Oh, you guys don't know.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of his name.
Yeah, I was that guy. I was like, oh, even though I didn't make that trade, gosh, what, you know, it was nuts, man. That whole thing was like leverage. Gosh, like, you could see how you could rug yourself. So now I'm a straight Bitcoin only guy. Like, I thought I understood some of the stuff. I didn't understand what I was doing. I had no idea.
Yeah, experience is a really effective teacher, man.
Yeah. You know, we call it tuition in life. Like, dude, yeah. I got an honorary associate's degree. You know, I got a GD in crypto.
That's good stuff, man. So, well, talk to me a little bit about how, I'm curious about your transition from enlisted over to commission, and then journeying into being a chaplain. Talk to me a little bit about how that played into you taking on your current mission that you're undertaking right now.
Well, you know, the short version of that is getting into being, I was a conventional forces guy when I deployed to 2015. I was working for the Air Force, and I got recruited by, there's multiple special forces groups, but the people running the Advanced Operations Base, or AOB at the time, which is a bunch of ODAs, or Operational Detachment Alpha teams, Green Beret teams that form an Advanced Operations Base. And so those guys asked me to cover down for them. They were a guard unit, 19 Special Forces Group guys out of the Northwest. And that's how I got into the Special Operations community. It's a very small community. And if you add value, it turns out that, you know, you'll find more work. And so I developed some relationships with these guys. And through a series of circumstances, a friend of mine was going to quit, got out. I was going to quit being a Green Beret. And he had done a bunch of other government agency work, and then was going to quit. I convinced him not to quit. We came up with this idea of we would hide him on my staff. So I did a bunch of paperwork and got him on my staff at the chapel in the Air Force. It's just so he could kind of recover. And then I decided I was going to retire. So I got him back to the 20 Special Forces Group. Over those 2 or 3 years, we became very good friends. And then we both went to work for a medical distribution company, a company that's an innovation scouting company for the DOD and VA. And so I was looking for human performance innovation, you know, pupillometry, things that they use, you know, we can tell how much cortisol is in your eye. We can tell if you have a neuro problem with the way your eye responds, those kind of things. Stellate ganglia blocks, how we can hit your vagus nerve and help people overcome, you know, symptoms of PTSD, those kind of things. So I was looking in that world as a human performance person, previously working with Jays and Green Berets. And then they were doing like operational medicine. So, you know, like how do you keep blood cold? All kinds of stuff if you're familiar with Special Operations Medical Association or SOMA, we were in that space looking for the latest stuff to bring to the field. And there's a lot of noise, a lot of, you know, people just make money in that space. So that's how we came to do return to duty. But I would say that the transition from enlisted to being an officer, it was really just a sense of trying to add value to the system that I thought was often really slow and dumb and uninformed. So I was pretty infamous for my pre-deployment briefs, my pre and post-deployment briefs, because usually the commander would come in and go, "Hey, we're all family." And, you know, the typical stuff. And there's a lot of great people in the DOD. Some of the people on our team are still in. But there's also a lot of just BS that we use just to, you know, rah-rah stuff that folks end up and say. And as a prior E, I knew it. And so the boss would be like, "Thanks for what you're doing. We're all family, blah, blah, blah." And the moment the commander would leave, I'd go, "With all due respect to the boss, turns out we're not family. And I'm not your family. When I deployed, you didn't come to my house. I don't know any of you. So I hope you prove me wrong, but the reality is we're not family. And even if we were, you know, I mean, Cain and Abel were family, you know what I'm saying? There's some dysfunctional families out there. The mafia is all family. So I don't know what any of that means, but what I can tell you is that you better prepare for crises yourself. You know, there's a saying, prior preparation prevents piss poor performance. And, when you're, I can say this to our whole audience, to all you guys right now, you have a crisis or multiple ones, capital C, lowercase c, on your calendar right now. It's to the right. It's buried. I don't know where it is, but it's there. And when you hit those moments, you need to think about how you're going to respond. You do not have any prior preparation for some of these circumstances. End of life issue, a scandal that breaks out with one of your best friends, an affair, whatever it is. As a chaplain, I've seen it all. Like madness. You'd be surprised. You wouldn't be surprised, but everybody's nuts.
I think entertained is the word.
Yeah, yeah. And so Jerry Springs sort of way. The reason I would paint that picture is because I would say, look, and because of that, the number one thing I think you need to do, I could be wrong. You could take my advice, put it with a nickel, you'd have 5 cents. Or 5 sats, right? You need to know where the peanut butter spread stupid and incompetence is in your organization. It could be your first shirt, your first sergeant. It could be your commander. But if you assume that all these supporting agencies are going to be there to help you, I can tell you from experience that some of these people are not competent because they made it through MEPS. I don't know how they made it through, but they're getting paid on the 1st and 15th, and they are no value. And not only are they no value, they're actually harmful. because they don't know what they're doing. And if they are in a critical position, I mean, sexual assault response coordinator, I mean, chaplains, I mean, commanders, sergeants, like these helping agencies, if you assume they're all good, then, and they give you help and you're not your best decision-making self in that moment when you're in crises because you haven't prepared for that, then they will inject volatility into the equation. And then we will be trying to undo that. So I'm not trying to get too serious, but I'm just saying, like, that was my experience, is that I wanted to be of value and I wanted to try to speak the truth and also be a professional and work hard and add value to my units. But we just got a lot of people pretending to be leaders because the DOD tells them they go to one course and they're like, you're a leader, you know? And it's like, you know, we talk more about leadership, and there are some tremendous military leaders in the United States military and in military history. But there's also just a lot of management and presumption. You know, a lot of these commanders and senior NCOs, they don't understand, you know, the power base of leadership, the multiple power bases. And one of them is, and the most powerful one is relationship and influence. And they often use position or whatever, you know, their multiple power bases. So yeah, that I decided I wanted to be of value as a relatively, I think of myself as a somewhat normal guy, as a chaplain trying to add value. So that was my, and there was a bunch of mentors and people along the way that encouraged me to do that. But that was my transition from enlisted to chaplaincy.
Man, that's amazing. Yeah, I'm really glad that you pointed that out. It's important for each person to really be their, you know, their first and last line of defense in every situation, because going in thinking that your chain of command and, like you said, the people in those key positions have it figured out and that they're actually capable of doing their jobs, I mean, that's a bold assumption right there.
Yeah.
And I think that probably most of us have run into those individuals that, you know, when it's time for them to, you know, do their thing and, you know, that crisis right. happens and it's like, hey, we have a crisis. Who's our person for this? Let's call them. And they're standing there staring at you like, is that my job? You've got a freaking problem. Or when they just come, you know, swagger in and act like they, you know what they're doing. Good Lord, man. I mean, they're just going to knock things over and spill paint all over the floor. And it just gets worse. Yeah. It's a wild situation. I mean, we're seeing a lot of it right now. I mean, that, you know, coupled with the latest new announcement that we may have some soldiers that aren't going to be getting their paychecks here, you know, in the near future. That's stiff. I mean, when you combine all those things, it's devastating. And so, I mean, it's awesome, you know, to know that there are people like you that, you know, that step up and, you know, and take their role seriously and their mission to bring value to those situations. It's good. Obviously we need more people like you in the military because they are few and far between, but, yeah, thanks for doing your part, man. That's awesome.
I was happy to do it. You know, the reality is too, like a lot of these problems aren't new. Right. So a lot of times we're sold these ideas that we're the absolute best. And yeah, I mean, like the Air Force has made more pink dust than anybody. Like, you know, we've killed a lot of people with bombs and just smoked a ton of people. But the reality is, like, man, I remember reading in professional military education, you dig through these stories that part of the unit, I forget what unit it was. It was North Africa. It was when AFRICOM was being stood up. There was a lot of guard people on that KAOC, Combined Air Operations Center. So there was a one-star general, I forget her name. She would go on to become a three-star, something like that. But like her people weren't even paid like halfway through that deployment. They didn't get their money, right? So you go back to 1776, some of these dudes are barefoot in New Jersey. You go back to Vietnam, there's no IBA. You know, you go to Iraq, they're in soft skin Hummers. So, I mean, to normalize the reality is part of what I wanted to do, is be like, hey man, like we can solve these problems. We can figure it out. You know, military decision-making process, read the Ranger Handbook. It's a lot of great things. Like I've learned a lot from the DOD, but nobody's coming for us. Like if you assume that your chain of command's got it figured out, like, no, it's the NCO Corps, the enlisted Corps of the United States military is the thing that has made us stand out. I think if you look around the globe, and you compare us to other military forces, it's the ingenuity and the enlisted corps that is second to none. My take.
At least they've got everybody vaccinated now. And I mean, that's really, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're getting shot at, like in soft skin Humvees and
totally.
just, just make sure that you're not doing anything dangerous, like not being vaccinated. Is
yeah, well, it was the number one readiness issue when they were pushing the shot.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So out of faithfulness to my country, I refuse to get it. It's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think this is worth talking about for a second, man, because there's a lot of guys out there that are listening to the show that are still in. There are a lot of officers out there that just need to be shamed. There are, and not just officers. I mean, just staff, NCOs as well, and anybody who's part of the complex. It's been pushing this thing.
Secretary of Defense, for goodness sakes. My God.
Yeah. If you're up for it, if not, you can just tell me to shut up, Kevin. But
I'm fine.
You can tell us that story, because I got to hear a little bit of it earlier. And I think it's definitely worth talking about, because I think it's inspirational.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, a couple things go into my decision-making matrix. One of them is the importance of my oath, right? So, I took the oath, I took the enlisted oath, and then I took the officer oath, and I took it without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, right? So I took it seriously. I still have it somewhere. I think it's my commissioning document got mailed to me after I got commissioned, and it shows you that your office is an extension of presidential authority. And then when I went to officer training course, they talked about, you know, the importance of being a professional and the importance of dissenting. There's a whole section. I remember we talked about this, but rarely do you see it. You should be a professional. And then also as a prior E, I thought it was important to memorize the enlisted oath so that if I was ever administering it, and I would often get called down the hall by the recruiter or somebody to go, hey, I got some troops in here. And so I probably administered the oath of enlistment, you know, maybe 50 times. And I enjoyed that every single time. It's one of the last things I did before I got out. And I think a couple things. So that's what made paying attention to the rules important to me. And when we went, so a little bit of context, 2019, I deployed to Al Asad Air Base with a PJ team. We were supporting the retrograde of northeastern Syria. So as our forces were collapsing out of there, and we had a bunch of special ops folks primarily in that space, we were trying to keep them, you know, we were supporting them as they were doing missions. And we all came late 2019. We go through Germany to do our decompression TDY. And then we go home, and I got sick. A lot of us got sick. I was watching the COVID thing start to pop off. I had been listening to for a while Chris Mortensen, the Peak Prosperity guy, and he's a virologist by trade. And he was talking about what was going on, and I was paying attention to it. And so then 2000 happened, early 2000, come out of my deployment time off, R&R. And then we had three deaths in the unit, one suicide. So one of our pilots ate a bullet, and I was preparing for the funeral. And the lockdown was happening, and it was bizarre because they were telling us, you know, we weren't going to be able to put the guy at Cape Canaveral. We weren't going to be able to use the chapel. So I had to get the base general to sign get him to waiver the requirement when the government was shutting down. So this is like March 20th. So I'm explaining all this because we lived through it, and our unit continued to function and operate. I was working with medical professionals in the special operations community. We flew an aircraft together. We trained together. We did all this stuff. And we were just like, yeah, let's not get sick and get each other sick. And then in doing the innovation scouting with a bunch of Green Beret medics, I was at the conference, and we were all talking about how we were grateful that we weren't being forced to get the vaccination, because it didn't make any sense when we were listening to it roll out. And then right after that, they said, you know, you guys got to get it. And I was open to possibly getting it. But then all the people that were going to start fighting it, medical professionals, some PJs, some physician's assistants. So I heard the dissenting opinions because they would come to me and talk about it. And then I saw all the documentation that a lot of these guys had about how it was illegal, about how it was unsafe. So there was just enough information for me to review to go, man, this doesn't make any sense. And I was watching Chris Mortensen and some other voices. So when it rolled out, we had a meeting, and the command team, we all went to a room, and it was the head shed. And the way it was talked about was we were just going to educate the troops. This is a reserve unit. So it's the reserve training assembly. and you have 1,200 people there, most of which are only there once a month. And we said, we're just going to educate them, give them the options. Tell us if you're going to get vaccinated, if you're going to apply for a waiver, or when is your plan to get it. And but the attitude in the room was dismissive of anybody who was questioning it. And I'd mentioned to Shane earlier, if you get a chance, look up Phil Zimbardo. He did the Stanford prison experiment back in the 60s or 70s, where he created this experiment. And out of that, he wrote a book called The Lucifer Effect, where bad situations, toxic situations can lead relatively normal or otherwise normal people to do evil things, to do crazy yeah. things. And he explains in that book what he calls the Lucifer effect if a situation's crazy. And if you think about it, like in a practical way, like if I'm out surfing and I see a bunch of bait fish, where there's a lot of bait fish out right now, and you're going to see big tarpon and sharks out there eating those bait fish. And those bait fish tend to stick together out of safety. And without going into all the, you know, academic part of it, we just like to be safe. We like to go with the flow. So if people start saying this is what you need to do, then the herd mentality takes over. Digress for a second. One year I taught some classes. I was trying to see if I wanted to do a PhD when I was in my 30s, and I was a reserve officer and I was teaching at Grand Canyon University. And I had this super crappy, you know, it was like a university success class. So I could try my hand at teaching and see if I wanted to pursue a teaching career. And one of the things I made all of our students do, as I had to fill some of the curriculum out, was I would make them watch The Century of the Self. It's a BBC documentary. It talks about how Freud and Freud's nephew, Eddie Bernays, who was the first guy in public relations, wrote a book called Propaganda. The Germans really loved it. Then they created focus groups for industry, and they worked with Wall Street to change the average American into a consumer. That was their idea, so that wow. we would express our personality through purchases. And they were manipulating the masses through dealing with people's unspoken urges. So like manipulating the masses has been part of our culture for a while. So all that to say, I began to see those things taking place where I was like, dude, the way my commanders and people were talking about troops who were wanting to resist, they called them dorm doctors. They made fun of them. And they didn't know in the room that I wasn't one of them, that I didn't appreciate that. Plus, pursuing a religious exemption, which doesn't mean you have to have a religious conviction. It means it needs to be a sincerely held matter of conscience or religious belief, right? So something has changed. And part of my job was to validate whether or not that commitment was sincere. And it can be fast. It can actually be overnight. You can become a conscientious objector overnight. You can become a Christian, a Muslim, or whatever. And if any of those things change your commitment to the service, there are ways you can express that, like our previous guest, Andrew, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, he demonstrated to me high moral courage to say, you know, and most people don't know what Chesty Puller really talks about. And he's one of the few dudes who read the book. He's like, this is a bunch of bullshit. You know, like, I shouldn't be doing this. And then The Creature from Jekyll Island. So, you know, those two things, like, man, they can be really challenging if you find those things out. So anyway, go through all that. And the way I watched leadership talk about this, things like who's the Green Beret officer that was on the other day? You guys had on the show?
John Frankman.
John.
Yeah.
John, in his article, talks about his interaction with the colonel who was asking him about it on his exit interview. And then he says something to the effect, the colonel says, you know, if somebody tells you what to do, you do that. Like if Secretary Austin says to do it, you know, if the chief of staff says to do it, you do it. And that is very dangerous for professional military officers, for senior NCOs to say. It's that doesn't stand on its own. That and then he replies, have you ever heard of Nuremberg? You know, so he reminded that guy. And so I saw that very same thing. And so I believe that we have cultivated weakness within our military system in terms of the kinds of people we promote. The system guys are the ones that promote the people yep. that like today, Robin Olds, some of these famous General Boyd, you know, the OODA loop, like some of these incredible leaders would be fired in a heartbeat because yep. they're thinkers. And I'm not saying I'm a better thinker, But in this moment, I felt like what was going on was just not right. And so I said that I would stay around and process all of the religious accommodation requests to make sure those dudes weren't hosed. So we did about 50. And then and gentleman's agreement, they let me, you know, retire as opposed to refusing the vax. So it was like I was done anyway. And I was at a place where I was burnt out from 17 years of counseling people and suicides and all that stuff. So I was not in a good place. I wasn't a very chaplain-y chaplain. I was like, you know, fuck these guys. Like I want to kick them in the face. And that was how I was feeling on an emotional level. You know, like we all have stresses and trauma and drama in our lives to some degree. But I knew that I was no longer an asset, that I had reached, I'd hit my expiration date as a chaplain. I could no longer be an asset. And that's okay. Like it's fine. Like, you know, mental health is a real thing and mine was deteriorating. I wasn't like walking around like, you know, very unstable, but like I said, I wasn't a very chaplain-y chaplain. Because I just thought it was such craziness, the way in which we were willing to get rid of some good people. I mean, like, I know there was a guy up at Northcom, an officer up there, special ops dude. He refused to get it. And he was just talking to some other people about it. And he was read the riot act. Like his commander was like, dude, you're sowing, you know, that dissension. Now, what's the number one responsibility of a commander?
Take care of your troops.
Take care of your troops. And specifically to maintain good order and discipline. Right. And so that's part of the reason why when Andrew is conscientiously objecting, they're like, isolate that dude because he can begin to erode good order and discipline. So it doesn't mean everybody who gets isolated is, you know, they're doing it for draconian reasons. There are some practical things like if I'm a commander and you're a dissenter, so there's a lot of dynamics in leadership, but the manner in which we did this and there was no pushback. So for instance, you look back at human history, you look back at this moment and you have them admitting that it didn't stop people from getting sick.
Yep.
Right. It literally didn't stop them. You have the adverse things that, you know, like the VAERS thing, you have actual problems with this thing. And then, when it comes to leadership, you have like one or two lieutenant colonels that are in, you know, like that stand up and say no. We don't have one colonel, like one general officer out of 2 million people. So, you know, however many officers there are, like what, 13-15% of the whole force. Yep. So you do the math, 200,000, right? So maybe 100,000. So then how many colonels are there's probably like, I don't know what the number is, but there's thousands at least, you know, maybe it's five, but not one.
Yeah.
And I know some of them felt the way I did. So my biggest encouragement and challenge to all of you who are still serving is, dude, serve with your whole heart, be fully locked in. It's not your job to be a political actor. Your job is to do the mission, right? Warheads on foreheads. You know, if you're there to do that and you understand what you're doing, do it. But you have to understand where your line is from a conscience perspective. A man or a woman should never violate their conscience. And I watched many people violate their conscience and there was many good reasons. There will always be good reasons to ignore the camp that's being built down the street, right? Forgive the...
The most powerful motivator in a lot of cases, and by the way, before I get to this, Kevin, I just want to say I'm really glad we connected, man, because in the last 42 minutes, you have been dropping some wisdom, brother, like condensed wisdom. So
that comes with a price, right? I mean, like I walked away from a career.
You obviously paid the price.
Insurance, all that stuff. Like, you know, so I paid a price. Like I'm still paying to some degree. And it's all good. I don't mind paying it, but, you know, pain's a teacher.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When it comes to these kind of things, you know, do the right thing. Do what's right according to integrity and character and the right thing, not the political thing. One of the big influencers, of course, is Providence, right? Like, how am I going to feed my kids? I've got 19 or 18 or however many years in the service. I don't want to lose my pension.
Yep.
If I take a stand, there's a chance I might lose all this. Right? Yep. And that's a problem. Because now you have men sacrificing their honor and sacrificing their integrity, not doing what they know is right, not standing up and being a man of valor, knowing they should do that,
Right.
But at the end of the day, and I'm sorry if I offend anybody. I really am. My intention is not to offend people, but you guys pushed out.
Yeah.
Because you're afraid of losing that income. You're afraid of losing that pension.
Yeah.
And I'll finish it with this. This is a problem with fiat.
Oh, yeah.
Because the bottom line is, if these dudes were stacking a form of money like Bitcoin for the 15 or 10 or 18 years, towards the end of their career, they would have a gigantic pile of fuck you money. And at the end of the day, if it came down to a political decision, am I going to do the right thing? Am I going to stand up? Am I going to be a man of valor and say what needs to be said? Or am I going to puss out because I'm afraid of losing that pension? They would tell them to stick it every time.
Yep.
And these, just to take this even further, these are your war fighters. This isn't, you know, one of those things where, and, you know, I know how we all feel about, you know, war and peace and everything else, but in, let's just say we are, you know, in a defensive position here in America, and, you know, we've got to send guys to the front lines in an honorable way. When you've taken the best and brightest, the self-thinkers, the guys that will think outside of the box, the guys will take action, the guys that will defy orders in order to keep either their guys safe or whatever their mission is moving one way or another, you've just eliminated almost 100% of those guys. And then if you have teams out there that are supposed to be doing, you know, the war fighting, in the back of their brain, you know, this cancer, this idea that's been stuck there, where they know for a fact in 2023, they're not dumb guys, or they wouldn't be in a lot of the positions they're in.
Yeah.
That cancer, that rot that's been stuck in your brain, that they said, hey man, you got to go out here and you got to take this experimental vaccine or shot, and now you got to go out and operate. As you're operating, that's got to just gnaw at you and eat at you. Like, I got to go out and put my life, my limbs on the line, my the fact that my family may never see me again, for these guys that wanted to poison me and did poison me through force and coercion. And at the end of the day, if I'm going to get my heart rate up, and we know what happens to professional athletes that are between 18 and, I don't know, 45, that hasn't happened like this in any time in history with myocarditis. Like, you're talking about, you know, guys in the back of their mind going, man, I can't overexert on a mission. I can't give it everything and then some of everything that I've got, because I am worried about peeling over and possibly dropping dead because of the force coercion. Yeah, absolute fiat to a T, because they needed to see who was with them and who was against them. And that's how they flushed them out.
Yeah. And the reality is too, like, the thing that pushed me over the edge, I mean, I was looking at my kids and I was actually thinking about the future. So I was actually thinking about the risk to my family, and that it's not physically safe. So that's why I was like, dude, I'm not going to try to get a religious exemption. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm opposed to using, you know, like, I think abortion's murder. Like, sorry if I offend you. I kind of don't care. Like, this is America. We should have the freedom to say what we think. I can work with you even if you know, have had 17 abortions. I paid for one when I was a kid. Like, you know, I've done a bunch of bad things, but I'm opposed to it. But that wasn't the highest order of concern that I had. My highest order was, like, my family needs their father, and this thing doesn't seem safe, and that's not right. So me, it was a matter of, like, they're telling me a lie and that doesn't make sense. And they're using language that doesn't make sense to me. So I can no longer execute my oath, because I can't. Now I do have mental reservations about this position, right? So I cannot put my constitution and honor the orders of the President of the United States. So I'm going to pick one. And that's what I did.
And that's an amazing point. I mean, because nowhere, you know, you mentioned the oath that we all took, you know, some of us multiple times for reenlistment, and this is not in line with that. Nothing that they brought down through the chain of command, none of those orders were constitutional at all. And you know, I took my oath seriously when I went in, and I think that a lot of people do. And it didn't say anything about this. It was about the Constitution. It was to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and not this garbage. And I'm, you know, and I'm sitting here listening to this and I'm trying to think of, you know, what are some of the positives that could have come from this? Because here we are. We have, you know, so many great leaders were pushed out of the military and now they're out here. And, yeah. You know, I mean, to me, it's, you know, of course, Bitcoin is perfect for these individuals because, I mean, this is just, you know, this is that mission that they were, that was removed from their ability to perform, you know, something that is purpose-driven, something that is truly changing the world and fixing things and impacting life in a way that, you know, so many people join the military to have the opportunity to do. And so, you know, the more we spread this message of Bitcoin and how this is the mission that they were looking for, it's, I just think there's a huge opportunity because we have so many veterans that just left in the past few years, and we have more that are on their way out because of this, that, you know, they're not going to reenlist when their time comes and they're going to be out here looking for a mission. We've got to get them plugged in somewhere.
Yeah.
Something else that I just want to touch real quick is,
yeah,
this happened before. This happened, you know, we've all experienced it to some degree or another, and it's been a common theme in a few discussions that I've had this week. But if it can happen once, it's going to happen again. They're going to try something like this is going to take place where leaders within the military are going to be put to a test that is similar to this. And, you know, it, of course, it happens in pockets. It happens to individuals throughout military history. But on a grand scale like that, I don't know of a time where it happened the way that it did with COVID, but it will happen again. And yeah, we still have people that are in the military right now that, you know, I'm going to venture to guess that they're probably living, you know, with a pretty fair degree of shame that they're carrying around right now because they didn't stand up, because they complied, because they just, you know, kept their head down and said, yes, sir. And they clicked their heels and they, you know, they were part of the manipulation to pressure their soldiers, to pressure their peers. And they're walking around feeling like shitbags because they did it. But I'm here to say that when that opportunity comes again, for any of them that are listening, I want you to remember what that felt like when you traded your integrity, when you traded your personal values, when you put them aside and you complied with something that you knew was unlawful, that was unconstitutional. Yeah. I want you to remember what that sting felt like, what mm-hmm. that ache still feels like now when that opportunity arises again. And I want to encourage you that your opportunity will come to the right thing. And remember how it feels and recognize it when it happens, because you will have another opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah, very well said. I mean, we all have integrity checks in life. At least I've experienced that. And I think it's true. Like, there are moments in our lives where we have to do commerce with our own values and morals. And the military is kind of fascinating. But I would say one thing we talked about a minute ago was, you know, the fiat thing. And I think there are some perverse institutional incentives that the fractional reserve fiat thing has, you know, created. And, you know, there's a guy, Andrew Basevich, he's a West Point guy, infantry officer, career, got out, became a political science guy up in University of Massachusetts. But he wrote a book called The Imperial Presidency and Betrayal of Trust, where he talks about the disconnection between Congress and the military, that there's fewer connections, you know, familial connections, people serving in Congress. And sometimes, you know, when you have this draft, a major war, it makes sure that the military is not used as special interest. And then you think about Dwight Eisenhower's comments, you know, as he leaves the Oval Office and says this complex is so big. So I think, you know, when you look at this broad system, you see that, man, there are some problems. But one of the things that I was talking to Shane about earlier is, I'm hopeful for America because, you know, America, Bitcoin adoption among nations, it's America's one of the highest, right? It's like number one or number two or somewhere in there, right? And there's still freedom here. And we are a nation that has a ton of scars, a ton of BS, you know, in our history. Like our kids are homeschooled and we just got like 20 books that they have to read for literature this year, the ninth graders. And like, you read Frederick Douglass's autobiography. Think about what it was like to be a black dude living in, you know, like slave America. And he figures out a way to read. He becomes a gifted leader And that was terrible. Like, you know, so Dr. King once said, you know, all we're saying to America is be true to what you said on paper. So the cool thing about America is that we have the ability to speak truth to ourselves and be like, hey, man, like, this isn't right. So you read Alex Gladstein's stuff on how this process works through the IMF, and you're like, dude, that's pretty shady. So the way we exploded in values, we extracted a ton of value from the Global South and the East. Like, so that's that's not helpful. And so, yeah, man, I think there's a lot of positive opportunity in the Bitcoin space, and it's utterly American to bring this kind of innovation and justice to more people. And so, yeah, I'll, going back to the integrity check thing, I'll share a brief story real quick. Because I was a street entrepreneur, I'll just call it that. When I went to talk to the recruiter, so I'd become a Christian dude when I was like 9, and I was serious about it. Like, I was reading the scripture. My mom and dad were in a violent relationship when I was growing up, and he left. And so I was already under stress as a child. You look at adverse childhood experiences, my score on there is like a 9 out of 10. And I'd come to know the Lord. I was reading scripture. I had a vibrant prayer life, all this stuff. And then my mom and my stepdad got divorced, and then we went into poverty. So projects, trailer parks, North Memphis, the shit was going down, baby, all day, every day. And I thought people were going to help me. I thought the church was going to help. It didn't. So I'm pretty sure I had a nervous breakdown, because I went from being a straight A student, student council president, sixth grade, to like, you know, living, I got shot at the first time. I was at Fraser High School, North Memphis. Walking home from school, I thought dude was pointing a drill at me, and it was a handgun shot at me. I ran home. And from that point on, like, dude, I was just like, all right, fine. I'm like, Lord ain't coming. Like, it's boats and hoes, you know? I mean, I was like, I discovered NWA and started smoking weed and selling weed. Right. So when I go to join the Air Force, I quit school, got my GED, went to college. I go to join the Air Force. I had a really good ASVAB score, but I go in, I tell the dude, I'm like, yeah, I've been arrested 10 times as a juvie. And so, and I smoke weed, you know, every day. And he's like, well, tell him you experiment with, you know, just say you experimented, right? So at the very beginning of my career, or my at the recruiter's office, the dude's telling me to lie. And I was hungry to get out of my situation. I wanted to go do something with my life. I wasn't just running from my past. I was running to something. I was actually ambitious. And that's why I didn't party. I didn't do any of that. I got my undergrad in 2 years. I worked really hard. But then I realized after like a year into it, I was like, dude, they're going to find out that I got in all this trouble. So I beat a DUI for marijuana. I was totally guilty. My friend got murdered one night. We got into a fight. Fight turned bad. Dude got shot in the head. And then I got arrested for felony possession of cocaine. I was 18 years old. So I told the recruiter all this. And he said just to lie about it, right? So I was like, okay, the dude's telling me to lie, I'll lie. So the whole first year in the military, I'm like, dude, these guys are going to catch me. And when I got to basic training and the dudes, like, they couldn't touch me, I was like, these bitch-ass dudes can't touch me? I was like, this is easy. So, like, they're yelling at me, and I'm just like, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's rich. Like, dude, I'll stab you in the neck if you touch me. You know, like, but I was kind of growing. I was like, okay, I need to learn to respect authority. I got to get right, you know? And so time goes on, right? Fast forward, I apply to go to the academy. This is the backstory behind the academy. I get accepted to the academy. I'd never taken the SAT. So for 3 months, I study the SAT book. I get a 1210. I only needed an 1150 to get in there. So I'm like, okay, I can go to the Air Force Academy. Sweet. When I go to they send me the package. I realize I got to go to the academy, and they explain the honor code. That you can't lie. And when I go back and look at all the forms I filled out, I'm like, holy crap, I lied a year and a half ago. And I was like, and at this point, I'd started to grow in my faith again. I felt bad for being a jerk, you know, and cussing everybody all the time when I was a teenager. So I was like, okay, Lord, I'm not going to go to the academy unless I can tell the truth. And so I told my boss about it. My boss thought he heard me say I had used, you know, I'd smoked weed since I was in. And he has my rights read to me. So I'm sitting there like, dude, this dude is a terrible NCO. And we were just telling a story, and now I'm, you know, the police are coming to talk to me. So I realized, like, you know what? I don't want to go to the Air Force Academy because I won't be able to tell the truth. So then I talked to the JAG, and I was like, hey, I want to change my paperwork and tell the truth on my paperwork. Like, you know, I shouldn't have lied about that. And they're like, oh yeah, you need to go talk to the Area Defense Council, the defense lawyer. So I go talk to the lawyer. He's like, yeah, you guys are like the Jesus people. You realize you told some lies and you can't fix it because it's considered fraudulent enlistment. So you're not going to be able to change it. So I'm like, okay, fine. Well, then later on, I'm just like, I'm just going to get out of the Air Force. It's been good to me, but I'm done. Finish out my next 3 or 4 years, get my, I was already in grad school, was working really hard, was grateful. So then some people encouraged me to consider being a chaplain. I apply for being a chaplain. And then on my forms, I tell the truth. The recruiter's like, dude, you can't tell the truth. This is fraudulent enlistment. And so I share this story because I had a moment of weakness. I'm filling out all these forms. I have to fill out the drug and alcohol use form. It's the Air Force Form 2030. And I have both of these forms, by the way. I have the original one where I lied, and I have the other one where I tell the truth. So I fill it out in front of the recruiter who's getting me into the officer corps, and I fill it out the same way I did in 1998. This is 2004. And I walked away from that office, and I was like, I'm a coward. I am a, what's the technical term? A gigantic pussy. And when I cuss, you know, to express actual, like, real things, right? It's not just for fun. I was a legitimate cunt in that moment. And I knew it. Like, I knew it not like an insult to myself. It was, I had folded, and it was the very thing I said I wasn't going to do. And so then I went home. I prayed about it. I talked to two or three of my friends, two of which were colonels. I said, and they were believers. I was like, look, man, I just don't think I can do this. I'm not going to lie. So I fill out the form at home. I tell the truth. Yes, I've used marijuana. Have you ever used narcotics? Yes. Have you ever trafficked them? Yes. Have you ever been convicted of felony? No. So then I go back into the recruiter's office. I hand him the form. I say, turn this in. He shuts the door. He's like, dude, you'll never be able to get in. You're never going to help anybody as a chaplain. I think you'd be a good chaplain, but you're never going to help anybody. I was like, dude, I'm up here pretending like I know God. Let's just say you don't believe any of this stuff that I believe. If I believe in a God who controls this whole universe, we're spinning through the universe, you know, we're flying through space at 67,000 miles an hour relative to the sun. We're spinning at about 1,000 miles an hour. If there's someone or some entity that controls that, and I think I'm connected to him and I'm going to try to help other people, if I don't tell the truth now, like, I'm just another like BS dude in a suit. So he turns in that paperwork. And they waived that, they had to get a waiver to let me in, but I told the truth. And in my personnel file, I have proof of fraudulent enlistment. So I always kept my career, like I held it very loosely. And I was thankful. I was thankful to God for the opportunity to actually have a second chance to tell the truth. And then every time in my career, when they asked me to go active duty, I had to revisit that. And over, like security clearances and all that stuff, I had to tell the truth. And people would be like, how are you in the military? And I was like, I don't know. And then when I went back to see about the waiver, I realized that the recruiter didn't submit the form. It was just a like vetting tool. And as long as his data entry was 90-something%, he didn't have to show everything. So I realized he actually never filed that. Right. So legitimately, like if you dug into my record, you'd be like, that dude shouldn't have ever served in the military. So technically, I'm not serviceable. I'm not the kind of social. I don't have the kind of moral character to serve in the military. So I share all that to say, like, dude, like I've faced multiple opportunities. And so we have many recruiters telling people to lie because of this old idea that if you smoke weed so many times, you're a deviant. So what is the psychological impact of coaching people to lie? And we see this with slide decks where people manipulate the stats so that the command looks better. Right. So, I just think we do a lot of things sometimes to facilitate deception and dishonesty. And then yet we go out in public and we act like, you know, we're these high moral character people, integrity first, service before self. And it's like, okay, why did we not do any non-combatant evacuation operations in Afghanistan? Like, why do we turn our backs on the dudes that helped us build charts, you know?
Good question.
So I'm just saying, like, dude, I'm the chief sinner in this group, you know? Like, I've screwed up way more than anybody else. But if you want the chance to tell the truth and demonstrate, you know, integrity, those moments will come. There's multiple opportunities in life. And I'm just grateful that I had any sense of conviction when it happened with this latest thing. And even if you screw up, man, there's hope to change all that. And that's what I like about Bitcoin. There's less about trusting dudes. It's more about like the system itself it's just a totally different system. There's not a bunch of fractional reserve BS. There's not a lot of deflation going on. Like, it's just a totally different animal.
So, okay. You know, go ahead. Go ahead, Alex.
I'm just going to say, we've been doing this for an hour and 3 minutes. This is probably the best, at least in the top two or three episodes we've ever done. Kevin is a straight badass, full of wisdom. He's got my thought. I'm going to vote right now. We need to get this dude back more because he's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll do it.
Amen.
Yeah, I don't know. How long is the podcast?
We roll
three more hours,
about 8:30 Eastern time here. And, I want to just kind of point out to everybody, like, what a good guy Kevin is. Kevin, I think out of this group might be the only guy that felt bad about lying to the government. I definitely.
True story.
Yeah.
Somebody in the chat was saying, the recruiter said, how many times have you smoked weed? And it's like, no more than three times. Right. Exactly.
Well, dude, that was the exact conversation. And it's like, but I mean, honestly, dude, like, you know, there's a joke in special operations. What's the difference between a criminal and what's the difference between criminals and special operators?
There's some things criminals won't do.
Yeah. That's a good one, but it's timing.
It's timing.
It's just like, dude, some of the stuff that, like, for instance, I remember one time. Yeah. I can't talk about a lot of those things. But there's a lot of cool stories, but a lot of those stories are in places and either chaplain things or you know, things I don't want to talk about. But there are here's a fascinating thing. Look up Kent Clisby. Kent Clisby is a great guy, Air Force linguist, then becomes a case officer for the CIA, and then becomes a headhunter. And he's in Silicon Valley when they're building Alexa and Siri. So when neurolinguistic programming and computing is coming together, he's there doing headhunting, and he becomes very good at it. He does what's called holistic contextual credibility assessments to determine whether someone's going to be able to do the job that the company's trying to find them to do. Very good at it. But he wrote a book called Willing Accomplices, where he talks about how the Soviets intentionally engaged Hollywood, education, and politics, maybe, media. And they played the long game to introduce political correctness into our culture. There you go.
Yeah, man.
So I talked to Kent about a couple things.
Accomplices.
And Kent would be like center left guy from a social perspective. And so he points out how this plan went down. And you know, some people would disagree with Kent, but he's a stud. And the point is, like, if you create, you know, a bunch of dishonesty and you incentivize dishonesty and a bunch of BS like that, you're just going to increasingly see that. So what are we seeing in politics? You know, Tony Cowden, the Green Beret guy that ran for office in North Carolina, he talked about the corruption with the Republican Party, how they, you know, they basically, the system guys went out and he said, you know, we have the government that we deserve. To some degree. And so I think you look at the military and you look at the government and you're just like, okay, we have a society that's asleep and we need to do more to wake people up. And one of the things that is waking people up is, if you go back to the thing I was mentioning about the century of the self and how the consumer, you know, the average American needed to be turned into a consumer. Well, now that consumer can't afford to consume as much. And as that consumer sees its ability to live dwindling, now all of a sudden they're starting to ask questions. So people are starting to actually wonder what inflation and debasement means. Mm-hmm. And then they realize, like, holy crap, like, you know, instruments of power, economic instrument of power is the dollar. And they realize, like, holy crap, like, there's something going on here. And you know, when my house goes up, you know, 70% in value in the last 3 years, that's not equity. It's debasement. Like, I can't move. I can't afford the house I bought 4 years ago. That doesn't make any sense. Why is my house worth closer to $1 million? And it's not $1 million house. It's dumb. Like, so people would be like, oh, you have an asset. No, I don't. I have a problem. Mm-hmm. And we all have a problem. That's scary. Yeah. And I think the average person is seeing, like, holy crap, what am I going to do? Yeah. I don't have the same purchasing power that I did. And so that is a problem. You're going to see people struggle. And that struggle is a gift. It's an opportunity, I think, for us to go, man, there's a lot of opportunity in front of us. Now, what do we do? So if we've all worked for this giant machine that destroys value, because that's what war in the end does. It takes all this ingenuity and it literally dumps it. It destroys where we're dropping bombs, and it takes all that talent and it puts it towards those systems. Well, when Bitcoin starts to actually build those layers so that we can attract all these businesses, and now all those services and businesses are involved in creating value, that's where I think the good news of all this is, man, some of the, now as the world has people working towards building things and value. So that's part of the reason why I've resisted going to work for Northrop Grumman. And after this podcast, I probably will never, you know, get any of those kind of jobs, but I don't want them, man. Like, I could go do that stuff, but why? Like, I don't want to build the future capability that we're just going to go drop, you know, waste away. So anyway.
If anybody's looking for books on this, Economics in One Lesson by Hazlitt is a great place to start. It talks about opportunity costs and why force and coercion is a terrible thing, because it incentivizes some of the best and brightest among us to go and serve for destructive purposes, and obviously MIC. Great book. I think Kevin, you're well past that, but I want to tell everybody, first and foremost, thank you for joining us tonight. If you're not here, Kevin Rush is our guest. This is being streamed all over Twitter. It's on Twitter Spaces as well. So if you have questions and you want to come up here and ask any of those, please feel free to go ahead and request that, and we'll bring you up and ask questions. We're getting into probably about the last, 20 minutes of the show. So wanted to kind of cue those up. And if you love the show and you like it, go down, smash the like button, smash that little bell, get some notifications on when this is going live, which is usually about every Wednesday at 7 p.m. for the most part. We're also Mike and Jordan, who couldn't be here tonight. We decided to fire Jordan. He'll be back at a later date, but we definitely miss having those guys here. But Kevin, I mean, I think having this as a more intimate piece here has been really good, because it's given a lot of floor time to you. I'm excited, and I'm kind of wondering what you're excited about, but I'm excited to see. We're already seeing Bitcoin bring together some really incredible people seeking out their niches, doing what they can for, you know, Bitcoin, for freedom, for this passion and mission that, you know, we all signed up for in the beginning, you know, and bringing these people together and re-incentivizing them and showing them that, you know, this, I don't know, path of the samurai, the path of the warrior, you know, this idea is not something that is cheap. It is not something that you can, you know, fake or call in or inherit. It is something that you must earn, and
proof of work.
Yeah, this is absolutely the best proof of work, and it's spreading.
Yep. And you have to do the work. That's the one thing I realize, is like, you have to try to understand it the best you can. You know, I don't remember where I heard this, but it was a while ago. I heard on a podcast, somebody was saying, if people are asking you how much they should put in Bitcoin, you know, like, the answer is none. Like, I don't know, like, go figure it out. Like, I can't tell you what you should do. You know, you need to understand this, because the more you understand this, the more you understand the bigger picture. So not everybody's going to read, you know, Lynn Alden's Broken Money. Not everybody's going to read the Bitcoin Standard, but you at least should look around and try to understand what's happening before, you know. We're moving to a world where people have to earn the right to make those decisions. So if you're trusting somebody else to do that, I just think that's really unwise. Like, that's a fiat system, to be like, hey, manage my stuff for me. We got any questions?
Yeah. Mike Hobart, go ahead and come off mute, man. So Mike's obviously our other co-host, and he had a power outage tonight. So Mike, if you're able to go off mute, you can stop raising your hand and take off that silly mute button and go ahead and ask.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Apparently some no-coiner normie idiot decided to take their frustrations out on a transformer near my apartment. So I am currently without power, but I wanted to ask Kevin, we've discussed on the show a couple times, the difficulties we've had with not only talking about like Bitcoin with currently enlisted and veterans, but also just talking about like the difficulties afforded, like the entire fiat system and all the economics that's going on. Are you seeing difficulties on your end with either one of those topics or both?
Yeah. So the way I think of it is like people are totally asleep when it comes to money. So I think because we are consumers and we in normalcy bias, we just wake up, we use money. We think our money's real. I think the money in my liquid, you know, my liquid cash in my checking account's real. And we don't know that it's not real, but I'll give you an example of how people are starting to wake up. So, you know, a friend of mine, actually an operator guy, is working on a deal to try to get some fuel into the country. You know, it's a deal that could change some people's lives. And he's trying to get like a tanker full of fuel and get some fuel distribution in the world. And the thing that's been holding these deals up is the transaction, is the ability to move, you know, seven figures or something from escrow account to escrow account. And the thing that keeps holding things up is the money system. So as people experience friction in the money system, it's an opportunity to go, dude, isn't it weird that we don't have control of our money? Like that not only does the, you know, so there are opportunities. So I find those are the presenting opportunities. And the one lesson that I've learned from being a chaplain is that you don't walk in and share with somebody that your perception of the truth they need to hear. So, you know, you try to find where people are and look for those opportunities. But money and the brokenness of the banking system, it's a hindrance. It's a problem. And they're taking money everywhere. If I do, if I try to raise money through our nonprofit, I got to give 3.something% to somebody to process this transaction. So I think there are definitely challenges because people are asleep. And I don't talk about Bitcoin all the time to my colleagues, but they know I'm going to the Bitcoin conference. And when we talk about it, I'm like, well, you tell me how that's going to help us. You know, I mean, how you're going to believe in that in the future when they just printed trillions of dollars. Like, how does that even make sense? So it's about asking people to think. And frankly, man, people are slammed. They're busy, right? So a lot of the guys I know were relatively middle-aged dudes with kids trying to get out or, you know, so, yes, I am. I do see it's a challenge to talk to them about Bitcoin and to talk to them about fiat, but there are practical examples of how those things create pain points in their life. And that's where we talk about it is like, you know, hey, there is a way to do this differently. Like I can send Alex sats right now. That's a totally different thing. So I don't know if that answered your question, Mike.
Oh yeah, definitely did. That was a good answer.
Yeah.
We got a,
go ahead. No, that's it.
I was going to say, we got another question from Nico over at Simply Bitcoin. Kevin, did Bitcoin play a role in changing your perspective of the role of the state?
Yeah, in the sense that, you know, when you think about the four turning ideas, you know, I forget the demographer's name, but the guy who's talked about the four turning, you think about Ray Dalio's Changing World Order. I wonder if we're not moving into a place where the role of the state and then the network state, what's the guy's name? Smart dude that wrote the network state. I think that the role of the nation state seems like it's going to change in the same way that monarchies and the role of like the states in Europe, you know, they dominated the world for a while, but that form of government had to change. And then, so I think the nation state has been helpful. It's been amazing. Like there's been a lot of human prosperity, but I see the nation state changing. It just because of technology. So I don't know what that means, but I've always viewed authority structures as meaningful, but also capable of creating great harm. So I love America. Again, I went to, you know, I gave a good portion of my adult life to it because I believed in the good part of it and trying to foster that good. But I also think that the state is big and cumbersome and can produce a lot of distortions, especially in economy. And that's where I think I was asleep to how much the Keynesian ideas were everywhere. So I found in my political science book from 23 years ago where they talk about Keynesian stuff and then they sort of make fun of other dudes real quick, but it's subtle. And then you move right on. So you realize like, oh, right and left are playing this game and it's a sleight of hand that we don't want to talk about that part, not the Fed. But thankfully, my brother, who's a dissenter 25 years ago, turned me on to Alex Jones and like all this stuff. And so I was like, oh, that stuff is fringe stuff. It's crazy. The Bilderberg group, you know, the Moloch worship and all this stuff. And I was like, dude, that's just crazy. It was entertaining to me, but it was fascinating that a lot of the things that those guys were saying that the state was doing is true. And you're seeing that come to fruition. So it's changed. It's actually made Bitcoin has made the state's deformations that it's injected into my life. It's made them make more sense. Previous to Bitcoin, I didn't see the answer to the money thing. I just knew there was distortions and I saw we were printing money, but I didn't know. There was no way I could fix that. So I just had to write it off because I had to go pay the bills.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is the, what do they call it? A keystone species or whatever. It's the thing upon which the whole ecosystem.
It's the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
It's the thing that translates and unlocks everything. Cause I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's so much that the government engages in that you can hear about and people would be just like, that sounds crazy. And the reason the only reason it sounds crazy is because you don't understand the motivations why a government would do something like that.
That's right.
Until you understand how the money and the financial system work. And then once you get that, then all that stuff is kind of like, oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Get it. If you map the fiat system and you map the money printing and the depegging of the dollar to gold and Bretton Woods, if you map that over everything else,
military industrial complex, a lot
of
things
make sense. And you're like, holy crap, this is just basic motivations. If they're at the tip of, if they're closer to the spigot, you know, that's the name of the game. You get closer.
Who is the biggest beneficiary? Who is the biggest beneficiary of the spigot over the last 3 years? Wild ass guess. Big pharma, bro.
Yeah.
Good ain't
us. And more importantly, just as importantly, those who hold shares, shareholder value, right? So those who know where the market's going, right? And again, those would be fiat distortions because you know ahead of time who's going to get the government tailwind on a macroeconomic level.
Yeah. That's, all cantaloupe. That's reality. Effect, right.
Yeah. That's those are the facts, son.
That's right.
Straight up. Don't question. I'll stab you in the neck.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I mean, there's maybe some people out there in the audience that are going, Jesus Christ. You know, they haven't been exposed to all of this kind of just flat out truth. And this week marked 9/11, the 22nd year after 9/11, and you're looking back at it now. And I know I was definitely going, geez, man, you know, when you look at this and you ask yourself that question 22 years ago, like, why on earth would anybody do such a thing? Powerful, rich, elite, poor, you know, why would anybody go after 3,000 civilians? And then you start to, you know, start piecing these, you know, puzzle pieces together over the decades now. And you start to see what was just, I don't know, you know, 22 years later, it's plain as day why this malincentive is there to begin with. And you're sitting there going, man, we didn't get the real story. The disinterested parties. And I mean, the people that run propaganda, the people that run the government, the people that run the banks, you know, this, you know, culture that's out there that's been created by this malincentive fiat counterfeit bullshit. And it is plain as day why they would do something like this. I almost say the first shot, but I think that's when the kinetic war began on the United States. And it wasn't, you know, some far off place. It wasn't just Saudi Arabia. Like there are some major league players that are right here, homegrown, that are doing things for fiat that you just look back and you go, oh yeah, it all kind of makes sense now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, dude, the Tower 7 thing, like the idea that part of it is just, you know, if you're willing to consider that the state will act against its people. So just conceptually, just don't think about the United States. Just put yourself in a different time of history and you go, oh, is that possible? And then you ask yourself like, if I'm Frederick Douglass, would the state ever act against me? You know, would we ever experiment on people, you know, like say, I don't know, syphilis, right? Tuskegee. Would we ever do that? Like, no, we wouldn't do anything like Tuskegee. Like, would we ever, you know, so, I mean, the reality is it's just not convenient to think about those kind of things. And then if you start to look, you know, like I voted for President Bush, like, frankly, it was the first two times I voted. I was a young man. I thought, okay, it's better than the alternative. Gore's crazy to me. And yet the Patriot Act was one of the most un-American things that you could imagine. And so I don't know, like I look at those things and go, I'm not sure what happened, but the fact that it's become almost religious in its power of that event, it's become such an unquestionable piece of American dogma. To me, that's like, that's weird, right? Yeah. Like you can't even question that. And they dropped Tower 7 and it's like, that's weird. So I think if you just think about the possibility that the state through perverted incentives, that certain people would begin to act out on those incentives. And we have multiple data points in our history where people say, be careful of this, watch out for this. Yep. So I think if that's possible, then those things are not above discussion. And the fact that they seem above discussion are weird. And that, yeah, to me,
you're big red flag, you know, right there, man. About it.
You know, I remember looking at the engine in the Pentagon and being like, my wife's a jet engine mechanic. And we were looking at that, that fan stage and we were like, that's supposed to be from what? Like, whatever, you know? So, yeah, I try to be careful right now because of the stuff I'm doing with the colleagues that I have in SOCOM. But, yeah, I think Americans, it's very American to question those things in a healthy way. That, it I mean, was. The First Amendment is constitutional. The fact that I even have to go, it means that we're already self-censoring to some degree. And that's weird. Yeah. Unless you're a commander who's in a significant position, you should be able to think about that and say something. You know, like, we died for that. People died for that generation after generation so that we could be free. Why in the hell are we so scared to even talk about that stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, let's pass it around a little bit here, guys, and kind of get some final thoughts.
I've got a question for you. You've given me a page of awesome books, resources, and documentaries. I mean, this is amazing stuff. I'm curious, what is it right now that you're studying that has your attention the most right now?
So I'm pounding through Lynn Alden's book, and then I just listened to Working in Public because I want to try to understand open source decentralized stuff. And OpenSats had a gig that they were advertising, and it helped me to understand. If you're trying to understand Bitcoin, it's a book that talks about developers and it talks about open source projects and the history of that. And Working in Public, I think, is a good book to understand the need to try to invest in the developers and the people who are maintaining the code. I think that's important. Not just layer one, but all that stuff. And it seems like if we can make sure that talent pool is growing, then there's decentralization. They're the guardians in some way of the whole thing that still needs some people at the gate on the fence.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, the way that we're planning out the overall talent strategy for the future of all of this is tremendously important. We got to have the right people in the right places doing the right things. So, yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and just, I mean, thanks, man. I mean, we've spoken before, but I mean, you laid it out for us tonight, man. I mean, you dropped some freaking bombs, and this, you've given me a lot to process. I'm gonna have to re-listen to this a couple of times just to soak it all in. And I appreciate you, man.
You're welcome.
Alex? Yeah. It's been a great show, man. I've really enjoyed listening to Kevin talking about a lot of this stuff. I mean, the man's purely, clearly got some experience and gone through some stuff to have the kind of perspectives that he's got. So really appreciate that. There's one quick thing, you know, I was watching this tweet from Dave Smith that he just posted, I guess it was a couple days ago, but he goes, isn't it crazy that almost no one in the political and media class talk about radical Islamic terrorism anymore? Then he goes on to say, there's no concern about it. And yet every emergency power that the government took in the name of terrorism, DHL, TSA, Patriot Act, etc., it's just part of America now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's messed up.
Weird. It's like now all of a sudden it's not important. Like they haven't gone anywhere, you know? So, I mean, like it makes you wonder what their actual real capability and reach was. Now, I know a lot of guys who mowed the grass and who did some work to put a lot of those bad guys in the ground. And I'm happy some of those bad dudes are dead who are raping kids and murdering people and all that stuff. But it is fascinating, right? It the next thing has come along, right? So now it's fascinating how the language changes. What's supposed to be important to me changes. And we're being fed images and messaging. So I think that's good to pay attention to.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up here. Kevin, man, I got to tell you, you know, listening to you tonight, I can't wait to have you back, first and foremost. You know, I hope you'll come back and see us tell us what you're up to and how things are going. I also
we're firing Mike and Jordan, so you can just take their place.
when I hear a guy who's been a chaplain who's been listening to trauma and self-inflicted trauma at that for as long as you did, 17 years, you know, I understand what it is to have people come to you in need and stupidity and everything else. And I got to tell you, it can be one of the most wearing, positions or professions, if that's what you are.
Yeah.
And so now to have you here with us, to have you firmly in this, you know, this orange space, man, it is, it makes me excited. I see this, you know, this renewal of masculinity. I see this renewal of the warrior spirit, and I see people who are patient and willing to grind and absolutely get after it for the right reasons, even when nobody's looking, and that's character. So to have these new leaders, and that's what, you know, I was talking about this. I think Mike Hobart was hosting something the other night, wondering, you know, how are we going to pull off some citadels and things like that. And I'm going to tell you right now, you guys, if you're here now, you are the leaders. A lot of you don't know it yet. You have no idea what's in store for you, especially as a Bitcoiner, after we go through, you know, the next two halvings, which is just a little over 4 years away. Two halvings is 4 years away. And that is going to absolutely change what you're doing if you're holding Bitcoin. If this is what we're producing, if this is who we're gathering, and we're starting to see, you know, this new incentive structure rebuild the man, the family, the extended family, the community. This is something, and deep down, some psychological, very American-esque ideas of protecting your neighbor and being passionate about your community and giving everything that you have at the end of the day and at the end of your life for your fellow man. Like, this is something that it absolutely is going to be unstoppable. So Kevin, I mean, just pleasure to know you, man. Thank you for coming in here and lightening up tonight. So I guess we'll wrap it up there. I think before the show, and maybe we'll end it with this tonight, maybe a little different. We saw this come out from Nico, and Nico was out in the crowd tonight, so maybe a good place to end this. But we have maybe one of the most popular guys on earth down in Argentina visiting, you know, Miley down there, who's running for president. And he is talking about a lot of what we're talking about. Have a listen to this.
Yeah.
For politicians, money is power. They always crave more. But because they don't actually produce anything, they've got limited ways to get it. They can hike taxes on the population and collect the cash at gunpoint. That's the most straightforward way. But it's also highly unpopular. Voters don't like paying higher taxes. They resent it. So over time, most politicians in most places decide it's a lot easier to devalue the currency. You keep the tax rate pretty much the same, you just print more money. At first, most people don't even notice that it's happening. The money seems free. This is how the US government just paid for the COVID checks and the war in Ukraine and pretty much everything else that Washington has done for the past couple of decades. Just churn out more dollars. You can see why it's a popular strategy. But what happens if you keep doing it year after year? We really ought to know. So to find out.
So, ladies and gents, Kevin, again, thank you so much. Thank you all for showing up. Gabe, Mike, and Alex, thank you guys for being here again. This is why we Bitcoin, because we are exposing everything. We are the light in the darkness. And when you can be the light, you can also be the love, as Martin Luther King said. If you can be those two things in the world, man, there's nothing we can't do. So go out there. Bitcoin, don't shitcoin, all that fun stuff. We will see you next week here around 7 o'clock on Wednesday. Peace.